Thank you, Bruce. I think I want to shift gears ever so slightly, and we'll come back to Bruce. We'll be asking him some questions a little later. I want to shift gears to another important and team member of the research department, Dr. Nick LaRocca, who has a title that's a bit of a mouthful as well. He's the Vice President of Healthcare Delivery and Policy Research. Which covers a gamut of rehabilitation, epidemiology, psychosocial research. Nick is a psychologist, and so when I'm facing challenges, I go into his office and talk to him, and he helps me feel better about myself. Thank you, Nick. We wanted to have Nick come on and tell us a little bit about the work he does, and also tell us a bit about a new collaborative effort called the MS Outcomes Assessment Consortium. So Nick, share a little bit with our listeners what you do in the healthcare delivery programs, and share us why we created the Outcomes Assessment Consortium, and what it means that why we're undertaking that effort.
Sure. Thank you, Tim, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. My job is somewhat similar to Bruce's in that I have responsibility for helping the society along with its scientific volunteers to make decisions concerning which applications we should fund and also to explore new opportunities to support research in various ways. The area that I focus on is a little bit different from what Bruce focuses on, so that my responsibilities are part of the society's holistic or broadly-based approach to research, and I focus on those applications that are looking to fund research in regard to the treatment of the symptoms of MS, like fatigue and cognitive changes, spasticity, and so on, and also rehabilitation efforts regarding exercise, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and various of the rehabilitation disciplines. Also, I help to coordinate efforts to evaluate applications that are looking to deal with some of the psychosocial and socioeconomic effects of MS, things like depression and cognitive dysfunction. I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. Keep going.
And also those applications that are looking at research efforts in regard to epidemiology, and so looking at risk factors that seem to put people at greater likelihood to develop MS. So it's an interesting mix of research opportunities, and it does keep us busy trying to explore some new avenues in those various areas. One of the other parts of my job has to do with working with scientific and other volunteers on special initiatives that are trying to advance the ways in which MS research is actually conducted. And I think most people realize that the society funds specific research studies, but what many people don't realize is that over the years, and this goes back to the very days when the society was founded, that the society has been really in the forefront of pushing the envelope in terms of how studies are done in MS, how research is conducted in MS, particularly in regard to the methods that are used in clinical trials of new treatments for MS. And so we're involved in a new initiative that's focused on that subject. As Tim mentioned earlier, there now are 10 FDA-approved treatments for the disease activity in MS, and these have made a tremendous progress for people with MS in terms of helping them to live better lives. But in spite of all of the progress that we've made, we still find that there is disease progression in MS. Not all of the treatments work as well for everyone. And also, as Tim mentioned earlier, There are certain types of MS, the progressive forms of MS, for which there are no FDA-approved treatments. And part of the reason for that, and part of the reason why we haven't made more progress than we have up until now, is that it's been very problematic to measure disability in MS, to measure exactly how the disease places limitations on people, and particularly how this unfolds over time. So we're involved in an initiative that has brought together scientific leaders from the academic community, also industry, also other MS societies, including the Canadian MS Society, the Italian MS Society, and the UK MS Society, as well as people with MS, to come together and to work with regulatory authorities, including the FDA here in the U.S. and EMA in Europe, to develop and test and eventually qualify a new disability measure that could be used in clinical trials for MS that would help those clinical trials to be able to find answers in a shorter period of time and with greater precision and reliability. And we're partnering with the Critical Path Institute, which is a public-private partnership that had been established by the FDA and whose mission is to help speed the development of new therapies for different disorders. And in this case, we've brought together over 40 different scientists, regulators, people with MS, and representatives from industry on a project that will evaluate a number of existing data sets from previously conducted clinical trials, evaluate some of the possibilities for different ways of measuring disability, and eventually develop a new and improved way of measuring disability, and hopefully get this qualified by the regulatory authorities here and in Europe for use in MS clinical trials. And our hope is that this will greatly facilitate the ability to do better clinical trials in shorter periods of time, and particularly to better address the needs of people who are diagnosed with progressive forms of MS. So that's the project. It's an exciting project and has brought together a wonderful collection of talent from a variety of different areas, and we're very optimistic that we will be able to move the whole science of how you do these types of clinical trials forward in the near future.
Excellent. I know we want to turn to questions, but I just have to ask. So when you said you're bringing data sets together, we're bringing together, as I understand it, you know, the data from clinical trials that happened in the past, so, you know, really big chunks of information, you know, that, you know, people participated in, the companies are going to deposit in. You know, big data is the big term these days, you know, about aggregating data, learning what we can from data. Would it be fair to describe this as the society's first big data project?
It certainly is a big data project, and the society in the past had formed a task force, and this is going back almost 20 years, had formed a task force to look at this issue using a similar approach, and the result was the development of a measure known as the MS Functional Composite, which has been used in a number of different clinical trials, but which has never really been qualified as what's known as a primary outcome for clinical trials. And now we're going to be going back, and we're going to be examining most of that data that's been collected over 20 years. So this is really the biggest data effort that the society has ever attempted. And at the present time, we're looking at about 20 different data sets from different clinical trials that have been done over the years, probably with a total of somewhere upwards of 20,000 patients. If you were to look at what it costs to actually collect all of that data, you know, we're talking about a value of something over over $100 million probably. And so this is going to allow us to not only do the analyses that are going to be necessary to help us develop this new measure, but also once that work is done, we will have standardized all of those data sets, and they will potentially become available to other investigators. So this will not only accomplish the development of a new measure, but will also provide an extremely valuable resource for scientists to look at other issues that can be addressed by those different data sets.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank you. Well, I know we thank you, Nick, and thank you, Bruce, for sharing with our listeners as to, you know, the work that you do and the important work you do for the society. Before taking on some questions that came in ahead of the call, I want to ask Heather if you have instructions for us as to what individuals should do if they want to pose a question to Nick, Bruce, or myself.
Sure. I think the operator, if you can let our participants know what they need to do, that would be great.
Yes, of course. In order to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Excellent. Well, while we're compiling, we're going to ask one question. I'm going to actually pose it to Bruce. Somebody wrote in ahead of the call asking, what is the society doing to attract young scientists to the field of MS research?
Well, thanks, Tim. That's a great question. It's a strong emphasis of the society to promote the best and brightest minds in the research in areas that are important to MS, to attract them and create an environment that's attractive to them to pursue careers in MS research. So the society has a number of different fellowship grant programs and opportunities for young scientists and physicians focused on clinical care of MS to support their research or support their training in clinical care or in clinical trials. It's an important part of our portfolio. We funded close to 30 of these grants at the last RPAC meeting, and it's a significant investment, and we're dedicated to supporting a young up-and-coming scientists and clinicians to pursue careers in MS research and clinical care.
Excellent. Thank you. And one of the facts I love to throw out when I give talks is that, you know, the Society's had a fellowship program since 1956, and we have trained hundreds of scientists and clinicians. At this point, you know, I think after this year, we're going to be hitting over 850 young scientists and clinicians have been supported by the Society, and many of these individuals have gone on to be leaders in the MS movement. In fact, one of them, Dr. Bob Fox, who was a Sylvia Lowry fellow trained at the Cleveland Clinic, was one of the lead investigators in the clinical trials that were leading up to the approval of Tecfidera yesterday. And so, you know, once we can get them hooked, we can definitely keep them in the field. So, operator, could you tell us if there's any questions for the group?
There are currently no questions from the telephone.
Okay. All right. Well, we have other questions, so if you think of other questions, let us know, and we will be happy to answer that.
Yeah. There is a question from Dana from Mechanicsville. Your line is open.
Dana?
Well, it isn't so much a question as a statement. I have the progressive, and I'm down to very limited use of one hand, but the importance of having a support system for people with progressive, that as they're working this way, whether it's through family, community, or whatever, it is vitally important. I am extremely active. I have programs going on tonight with a physical therapist. We have weekly yoga exercises for people with MS, and I have been active in programs in the whole greater Richmond, Virginia area for people, but it is a support system that it's vitally important for these people to continue on along with the importance of your studies for help. But I thank you all for everything you're doing. But please, those people need to put in place things. My support system is actually in the hundreds. It goes beyond. But it's a whole history, but I can't go into all that now, but I've been very, very fortunate.
Well, thank you, Dana. And you know, you really make an important point and an important reminder that, you know, particularly for those living with progressive MS or advanced MS, you know, having a strong and robust support system is something that's critical. And you know, we certainly are going to focus on that, the society, through our, you know, addressing the challenges, and we want to address the challenges of people who live with MS, and that is part of why, you know, in the Progressive MS Initiative, we have, you know, the issues of symptom management, rehabilitation, support systems. You know, research in that area helps us inform the kinds of programs, the kinds of rehabilitation programs, and the other support services that need to be made available for individuals like yourself, Dana, who live with progressive MS. So thank you for that statement and reminding us of the need to continue to focus on that. We have some other questions that I'll throw out. I'll ask Nick this question. So Nick, you've been working in MS research a couple years. I think a few years, you tell me. And Nick knew one of the people that tested Copaxone long before it was an approved therapy. So one of the questions someone asked us is, you know, when we think about the promising paths to a cure. I'm going to ask Bruce this as well. You know, when you think about the promising paths to a cure, what do you think about? And Bruce, be thinking about your answer to that question too. I'll come to you after Nick.
Well, I think about a lot of different things. And as you said, I've been in the field for a few years. I won't tell you how many, but I was in the field before we had any FDA-approved treatments, where we were really struggling, and we had symptomatic therapy and we had rehabilitation, but we really didn't have anything that seemed to have an impact on the disease. And you know, now it almost seems like a dream that we have so many options for people with MS. But I guess what I would see as the next frontier would be, and we talk about stop, restore, and end, and I guess for me, the next frontier is the end part of therapy. And can we find something that is going to prevent MS from ever starting? You know, right now we're doing a very good job of treating MS once it appears, but can we find some way to prevent MS from ever appearing in the first place? So whether that would be some kind of a vaccine or whether it would be identifying some critical risk factors or triggers or a combination of those things, that's what really excites me, the possibility that we could really prevent MS from ever getting started. So,
great, thanks. Well, thank you, Claude. Bruce, sorry. Your concept of a promising path to a cure.
Well, it's always hard to follow Nick on one of these things, but I appreciate the extra time. I'm not sure it was an advantage to me, but I think, you know, my perspective also goes back quite a ways because, you know, my mom has MS and has lived with it for 30 some odd years. So I have this perspective as well of a time when it was almost extremely difficult to even diagnose MS. And now we're in this age where we have now 10 disease-modifying therapies and a number of candidates in the pipeline. I think we've made dramatic strides in understanding the sort of basis of relapsing MS and the immunology that drives that form of MS and all of the disease-modifying treatments. Although BG12 might be partial exception to that, but vast majority of them all really are focused on the immune system. And I think the next frontier in my area of research really is helping or understanding this remyelination process that I alluded to in my previous comments, and the ability to protect the nervous system from damage. So I see a cure, or a functional cure, being the ability to stop the immune system from causing the damage, and being able to restore the damage that's already been lost through protection of the actual nervous tissue of the cells and axons and neurons, and promoting remyelination, and the combination of that stopping the progression of disease and repairing or slowing down the progression through remyelination and protection of nerve tissue, that combination is going to be a functional cure, I think, for a lot of people, and that's something perhaps in my lifetime that we'll achieve. This concept now that we hear, you and I, Nick, and others on our team at some of these meetings, of this disease activity-free status is one that was unheard of probably 5 years ago, and now is talked about commonly at these meetings, this idea of people having no clinical or imaging or otherwise signs of MS is something people are talking about, which I think is really, truly amazing.
Well, thank you both. If I put you on the spot, there's one question I'm going to answer, and then I'm going to turn the floor back over to Heather, who will introduce Cindy again. You know, Brian from Pennsylvania writes, you know, what's the society's opinion of stem cell treatments, and are we funding any trials? And, you know, he's heard that the FDA suspended trials in the U.S. So in terms of stem cells, the society is supportive of stem cell research. We, in fact, fund stem cell research, all different kinds of stem cell research, adult stem cell as well as some embryonic stem cell research. We are supportive of, you know, efforts to try to understand if stem cell transplantation can promote remyelination or repair the nervous system. We are participating in at least in one trial in part that's being funded principally through the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program at the Cleveland Clinic that are using bone marrow stem cells as a way to modulate the immune system. Our Fast Forward subsidiary is funding also some work with a company called Athersys that's developing a stem cell strategy for nervous system repair, and that company is moving its program forward potentially into the clinic sometime next year. You know, when it comes to the FDA, the FDA hasn't officially suspended all trials. You know, the way the FDA views stem cells is they treat them like a drug, in a sense that, you know, if you're going to take a stem cell out of a person's bone marrow and put it back into them, say for a stem cell transplant, you know, the company or the clinician doing the work really can't manipulate or treat those cells in any way before introducing them back into the individual. And so that's where the FDA gets involved. If a company is saying that they're taking a stem cell out and then they're growing them in the laboratory and doing all sorts of manipulations to them, then that raises a whole series of concerns about, you know, if you're going to put that back into the person, is it safe and effective and the like? And so there's been a lot of therapeutic claims that have been made, and that's where the FDA has come in, where they've gone in to say, you know, either you're treating those stem cells in a way that doesn't assure that they're safe when you put them back into the individual, or that, you know, you don't have the data to back up your therapeutic claim. So that's where the FDA has been getting involved. But there's definitely a lot of support for stem cell research and treatment, both at the FDA as well as robustly through the society as well as through other funding mechanisms. So thank you, Dana, for your question. Thank you, Nick and Bruce, for your dialogue with me and the questioners that sent your questions in at the beginning.
Excuse me?
Yes?
We do have another question from Richard from Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay, Richard, since we're heading up to the top of the hour, give us your question and we'll try to give you a quick answer. Richard?
Hi. So I guess what I was curious about was I noticed in the MS explanation of or the announcement of Tecfidera as being approved, and again, I just noticed, Bruce, what do people think is the mechanism? What is going on with Tecfidera, and what is it doing? And if we understood that, then maybe it would lead to, you know, other attempts to do the same thing in different ways.
Bruce, you want to take that one?
You want me to try to tackle that one? Yeah.
You go ahead.
So the putative or the mechanism that's thought to be involved in tecfidera mediated through a signaling pathway called NRF2 or NR2F, I can't remember. And it's thought to work two ways. One, by reducing inflammation through a signaling mechanism called NF-kappa-B. So it essentially is turning off some of the soluble factors the immune system makes that promote inflammation. It also seems to have some neuroprotective properties because it turns on an antioxidant pathway in nervous tissue. So it's not completely defined the mechanism, but those are the two ways it's thought to work, which do suggest that it would have activity both, again, in suppressing the immune response, and it's clearly it's been tested and approved in relapsing remitting disease, but I don't know what the plans are for Biogen with this, but I suspect that there is evidence that it would have neuroprotective properties as well and could potentially have some role to play in progressive disease. I don't know, Tim, if you know any more than that about progression.
I don't know that the company's taking this on in progression as yet, but, you know, you put your finger on an important issue, Bruce and Richie, that, you know, Tecfidera may have a couple of ways of working, and so we'll probably need to learn more as it comes out. It's not as not entirely working in one way, but I think that's the good news aspect of, I think, MS research and where we are is that, you know, we can think about the impact of the therapy not just in the immune system but also in the brain. So thank you, Richie, that's our friend Richie Sliska, I believe, from Boston. Since we are over time, we certainly appreciate everybody with your patience. I'm going to turn the floor back to Heather, who will take the call to the end.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't any other outstanding questions before we move forward.
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay, fabulous. Well, thank you, Dr. Kutze, and thanks to Dr. Bibo and Dr. LaRocca for sharing your time and expertise to provide this informative discussion today on the Society's comprehensive efforts to advance MS research. And certainly thank you to all of our participants for joining us today and for supporting our NOW research campaign to move us closer to a world free of MS. And before we end today, I'm just going to pass things back to our CEO, Cindy Zaghi-Boilo, to make some closing remarks.
Well, I'll add my thanks to everyone who joined the call together today, and thank you to our speakers. Very informative, and a lot of interesting things happening in MS research. Those of you on the call may want to participate in a more up-close and personal opportunity that we have to really witness the Society's rigorous research evaluation process. We have two opportunities upcoming which require reservations, so I do want to make sure that you know to contact us to find out exactly what to expect during these opportunities and to let us know that you plan to attend. There's one on May 17th. Both of these times are in New York City. We have a peer review Committee B meeting, which will happen on May 17th. And Committee B Tim, tell us what Committee B is again. They have these really elaborate names for these committees, A, B, C, D, and E. So, Tim, what kind of research is Committee B?
Committee B is the discovery research, like Bruce oversees, you know, immunology, glial biology, and it's a more fundamental type of research.
It's an interesting kind of research. There's going to be a lot in these meetings, these peer review meetings. There tend to be the scientists are really speaking to each other in large part, so sometimes they're not too careful with how technical their language is. So it can be a little bit hard to follow in my experience, but they can be very interesting meetings, and you really get a sense of the rigor of our scientific review process. Another meeting that we have coming up is on June 13th and 14th, also in New York. It's called our Research Programs Advisory Committee meeting, and this is where advisors from around the country join and come together, and scientists and some lay people. For instance, Richard Sliska is on that, as well as Mike Bogdanoff, who I believe is also on this call. So we have some lay people who are also part of this process. And we talk about what some of the up-and-coming issues and concerns are in research. We look into the future. And we're also looking at the entire portfolio of research that's been deemed meritorious by our peer review committees so that we can determine what best investments to make in MS research in this cycle. So it's an interesting meeting to have. We'll have a dinner that goes along with that so people can get up close and personal with some researchers and have some conversations as well. So I hope you'll consider joining one of those meetings. Just reach out to us and let us know if you're interested. Some of you have already received invitations, and perhaps a couple of you have been attended before. But I want to know anybody who's on this call that you're welcome to attend. So let us know if you're interested. And thank you once again for joining this call and for all you do for the National MS Society. We'll sign off now, and we look forward to keeping in touch. Thanks so much. So Tim, what kind of research is Committee B?
Committee B is the discovery research, like Bruce oversees, you know,
okay.
Immunology, glial biology, and it's
okay.
It's a more fundamental type of research.
And this is sort of, it's an interesting kind of research. There's going to be a lot in these meetings, these peer review meetings. There tend to be the scientists are really speaking to each other in large part, so sometimes they're not too careful with how technical their language is. So it can be a little bit hard to follow in my experience, but they can be very interesting meetings, and you really get a sense of the rigor of our scientific review process. Another meeting that we have coming up is on June 13th and 14th, also in New York. It's called our Research Programs Advisory Committee meeting, and this is where advisors from around the country join and come together, and scientists and some lay people. For instance, Richard Slifka is on that, as well as Mike Bogdanoff, who I believe is also on this call. So we have some lay people who are also part of this process. And we talk about what some of the up-and-coming issues and concerns are in research. We look into the future. And we're also looking at the entire portfolio of research that's been deemed meritorious by our peer review committees so that we can determine what best investments to make in MS research in this cycle. So it's an interesting meeting to have. We'll have a dinner that goes along with that so people can get up close and personal with some researchers and have some conversations as well. So I hope you'll consider joining one of those meetings. Just reach out to us and let us know if you're interested. Some of you have already received invitations, and perhaps a couple of you have been attended before. But I want to know anybody who's on this call that you're welcome to attend. So let us know if you're interested. And thank you once again for joining this call and for all you do for the National MS Society. We'll sign off now, and we look forward to keeping in touch. Thanks so much.